Okay, good afternoon. I'm pleased to see that so many of you made it. I was getting in here about a half hour ago, and it sort of reminded me of the fall of Saigon. Everybody was in a vehicle trying to get away as quickly as they could. I half expected to see a helicopter coming out with Judy and a few key people and somebody hanging on trying to be the last person out. At any rate, I think the forecast is it's pretty much going to stop soon, and assuming the road crews go through and go a plow, it'll probably not to be too bad going home. At least that's what I'm hoping. As I was prepping, I just noticed there was a clock behind me. Has that been here the whole time, or they just put it up? Okay. I was wondering as I noticed that. That set me to thinking about something. A lot of times, circumstances come up there and make you feel particularly young or particularly old. And I'm going to make myself feel particularly old and ask for a show of hands for people who have actually dialed a dial phone, you know, the click, click. That many. My God, I'm impressed that, you know, usually you get a vacant look. But here's something that really make you feel old on situation. Every year in the fall, they bring out a list of things to expect from the incoming freshman class. And it's probably true this year, but last year, but for sure this year, which would be the class entering in the fall of 2015, almost none of these students entering as freshmen will remember 9/11. Just do the arithmetic and situation. That'd be 14 years ago. They're typically 17 or 18 coming in, so they'd be 3 or 4 years old. I mean, they were probably alive, but at 3 or 4 years old, even as traumatic an event as that probably doesn't stick. So I mean, it's the situation, you know, for people in my parents' generation, it was Pearl Harbor. For my generation, I'm actually one of the people who remembers Kennedy being assassinated, and almost all of you remember 9/11, but the incoming freshmen, you know, 9/11, that's as ancient as Lincoln being assassinated or Washington crossing to Delaware or whatever it might have been. Oop, my machine went, we don't need that for a while. So at any rate, to get started, I have some notes I'll go over, but first thing I want to do is pass out, and you may already have done this, is the next assignment. Now, this is not going to be due for a while, but I'm going to be talking about scanning extensively today, and it's certainly apropos to the project. So if you printed a copy out, take another copy. It's on the UW or just pass it along. And certainly next week, which is when our first project is due and the second one's clock starts ticking, I'll be talking in some detail about what it is you're asked to do. But basically, as I've warned you in advance, it's building a scanner and particularly using a scanner development tool, something called JLEX. So those of you who are developers and found programming Project 1 pretty easy, I'm not surprised. But Project 2, it'll be programming, but in an odd sense, because it'll be in a new form of programming where you don't tell so much what it is you want done step by step, which is traditional programming, but rather you give definitions which a tool will recognize. And most people agree this is probably the way people would like to program. It's been a long-standing goal to have programs that are rule-based rather than procedural. That is, you give certain rules and a computer is smart enough to figure out from the rules what to do. And in fact, for some of that, I certainly hope it's true. As you know, Google's working on a driverless car. And that's something where in future, particularly if my driver's license ever gets pulled, I'd certainly like it. But just think of all the rules that are based in driving. You know, it's not do this, do this, do this, do that. It's like find yourself the driveway, turn left or turn right. If there's a biker, try to avoid them unless they're from the UW, in which case you run them over as kind of a common service for humanity and that sort of thing. So we won't be driving, running over any bikers today. So if you're a biker, I apologize profusely, but I've had more experiences on campus with bikers than I care to admit to. So this is Project 2, just going around. You can glance at it at your convenience. Oops, got a few stuff in front of it. And I'm just guesstimating how many are there. So if some extras come, get to the end, you know, just pass them to the next group. And if you're in the back, I hope you'll get one. So I'll let those go through. I won't be saying too much about that for the next couple of minutes. But what I want to do is sort of put to bed some of the remaining details from Project 1. Again, it's not due for a week, so you have plenty of time. You should have started, at least to the extent of downloading the starter package and getting that working on your own particular development system and making sure you have some sense of what's going on. In fact, we're at the stage now where people are pretty much done because I'm getting questions not about the main project, but about extra credit. And I'll talk a little bit about that. One thing just for completeness, about 10 days ago, not this past weekend, but the one before it, some sharp-eyed student noticed that one of the tests I had for my analysis, and it was fine for my analysis, wasn't so good for your analysis because it had a scoping error. And I could say, oh, I was planning that, and it wasn't. It was just sloppiness that it worked on mine, and I didn't read it as carefully as I should. So what I did is I posted a variation on it that is scope correct and therefore should run through your analysis properly. But what I didn't do until earlier this afternoon is put the expected output. So if you find that message on Piazza, toward the bottom of the dialogue, there'll be a little entry I add in, oh, by the way, here's what I expect as output. In most cases, you can probably figure it out yourself. It's not terribly deep. If you understand scoping, you can easily figure out for small programs what each identifier maps to, find declarations, read the line number, etc. So that's just there for completeness. In fact, I had one other question this morning, and I'm not sure if that's resolved or not. At least one person was having problems getting scanning errors on a program that he had created himself. And the interesting part was that it was always at the end of a line. And my conjecture, and I haven't heard back from him, so I'm not positive, was that it was probably, the file was probably prepared on a Windows machine. As some of the old timers may know, going way back, Unix machines and Mac machines, which are based on Unix, have a convention that end of line is represented by a new line. But Windows, going back to pretty early generations, had not, I'm not sure if it was not a new line or besides a new line, a carriage return, which is a separate character. And that was their ending of a line. Now, on the thing I put together, I was expecting a new line. And I believe with common text editors, you can set an option that says when new lines are created, at the end of line, insert a new line or a carriage return. Now, is that person who emailed me here, was that the problem? Did you dig into it? That was it. Okay. So if anybody else has that problem, what happens, the symptom is you get error messages saying that you have an invalid token, but it's only at the very end of a line. And what's happened is simply that your editor is putting in these carriage returns, which are unexpected rather than the new lines. And was I correct that you could set an option and it would put in the new lines for you instead of the carriage returns? Yeah. So it's a fairly minor thing, but if you haven't seen it, it's one of these innumerable gotchas that computers love to get you with. But that's one of the good things, really, because that's what keeps us in business. If computers were really as easy to use as people wish they were, what would we be here for? And it's a situation that's like, do they pay you, I don't know what you get paid, but do they pay you $25 an hour to go out to Miller Park and drink whatever you like to drink at Miller Park and eat hot dogs and watch the Brewers sometimes win and more often lose? The answer is, of course not. Any fool can do that. It's the hard jobs that get paid well, and computing is certainly one of those to the rest of the world. So we'll figure out all the tricks, and I'll explain them all to you, and we'll still be keeping the good money so that we can afford to go to Miller Park and eat the hot dogs and drink the whatever. So at any rate, that's Piazza. Let's talk a little bit about error handling, and that, again, is not as difficult as you might fear. What I handed you out was a little unrealistic because it assumed only good input. Now, that's as foolish an assumption as you can ever make. In your business, I'm sure that you have to make all kinds of assumptions of crazy inputs, misuse, etc. And it's one of these surprising things that an amazingly large number of programs fail if you give them egregious enough input. Some of you are doing your tax and you have TurboTax. Someday you should try it after your taxes are out and say, how many dependents do you have on a little spot there? And you say down there, 17,000. 17,000, what is that? Well, I own an ant farm, and those little buggers really expect to get fed or whatever. So something like that, or a negative number where a positive number is expected, or an illegal character. Say maybe when they ask you to type your name, put it not in English but in Cyrillic or Hebrew or Arabic or whatever your second language is, and see what kind of cool things might happen. So it's a foolish assumption to assume that programs are correct, particularly for a compiler, where people are learning programming and make errors. So this was just a simplifying assumption to get us going. But let's talk about the two errors that might occur in the sort of analysis you're doing. One of them is that you have multiple declarations. That can happen because somebody meant to do a scope, or perhaps they thought there was a level of overloading there wasn't. Many languages allow some overloading, but very, very few languages allow unlimited overloading. That is where you can have a symbol mean, the same symbol mean a method and a constant and a variable and a parameter and on and on, and the system somehow figures out from context or details or inquiry what you mean. It's conceivable, but that's not likely. So maybe somebody misunderstood and thought there was a kind of overloading that doesn't exist. Or it could be simply that you mistyped, particularly if you're like me and you like short identifiers like I, J, and K. Certainly easy enough that you meant to type a J and I, is I and J near each other? Yeah, they're pretty near each other. So you meant to type an I and you got a J or vice versa. So those things certainly do happen. So the question is, what sort of message would you like to give, and how hard will it be to modify your solution to do it? Well, it turns out my recommendation is handle this almost as if it were a valid declaration, except. Except what? Well, one, how do you find it's invalid? Well, typically when you add a declaration, you enter it into the symbol table for your current scope. New declarations are always in the current scope. So far, you could assume that that worked because there would be no prior declaration. Now what you do is you do a lookup first and say, is this thing already in the current scope? If so, what I'm about to do would be illegal. It'll be a multiple declaration because we're not allowing any overloading, at least at this stage. So you say, okay, here's a declaration that's illegal. I have to tell the user it was illegal. So what I'll do is I'll create part of the data structure that I would if it was legal. Namely, I'll go in and put the line number it's at so the user can find it and edit it in some way, the name so they can know what you're complaining about. But instead of giving a valid type, I would replace it with error because this is an erroneous declaration. So its type is sort of error. Now, we'll talk more about that in future, but among valid types, it's oftentimes kind of nice to give something an error type, too, which says, yeah, I know about it, but there was something bad about it, so that, yes, I know it exists, but I'm going to mitigate my analysis, so I'm not complaining about things that I know to be erroneous. And that's a good way of doing that sort of issue. That's all you need to do. What's going to happen is uses are never going to map to this declaration because it never goes in the symbol table. So it can never be found, and it can never be used because it's illegal. So that works fine. So you do a tiny amount of extra programming, but not very much, and you get a good thing in terms of getting a readable error message. The second class of errors are undeclared identifiers. The way you find these is, presently, you assume there must be a valid declaration somewhere. So you look at the current scope, the next scope, the next scope, and somewhere it's got to be found. Now you extend that lookup so that it may not be found. So another way to visualize this, there's this vast scope containing your program, represents all the identifiers that you might have used but didn't. And what happens is if your lookup goes past all your declarations, it goes into this table of identifiers that may have been used but weren't, but now was used illegally. So you put it in this table. You can go ahead and start linking uses. You can't give it a declaration number nor a type because it doesn't have any. So all you do is create this table and populate it with identifiers and list down there all the places they're used. So you might say identifier F was used at lines 7 and 9 and 14. And that would be a hint to the user, go back and find those lines, figure out what you meant to define there or use, and correct it. If you want to be a little fancier, you can go ahead and sort the identifiers. That's not absolutely necessary. I did it in my solution because I wanted to try the generic sorting. What happens is, if you have a table, there's an iterator. Iterator is one of these cool things that Java and advanced languages have that says, feed me one by one the entries in the table. Now, I don't think the iterator is guaranteed to put things out in alphabetic order. I'd have to verify, but I wouldn't count on it. But it's not bad. It simply says, if you've got 10 items, feed me those items one by one by one. So it feeds you out the name. You look it up in this table, find the list of places where it was used, and print out identifier and the list of uses. And then, you give it a title line that says, here are undeclared identifiers that were found in the program. So that's not too difficult either, a little more programming. But now you have the two worst errors that typically might occur covered, and your program is more realistic. And of course, they get you extra credit. So even if you do perfectly on this part, you'll still be able to carry forward a little extra credit to remaining project parts. So it's a pretty good trade-off, I think. So any questions on that? Mean multiple with the same identifier? I just print out on each place it was occurred, I'd say this is illegal, and I wouldn't bother trying to link them all together. because I don't necessarily assume that's going to be a terribly common error. So if there was a valid one at line one, that gets handled properly. And 7 and 10, it's just each one of them is handled independently. So it's got that name and it's illegal. Because the notion is you got to go to that declaration and do something to it because it's not going to work as it stands. And each one of those has to be fixed. So I'll get into this in future, but my sort of ideal for error messages, and I can't always do it, but I try, is one error message per error. One of the difficult things about learning programming, you may have had it, some of you others, is that occasionally you make a minor error and you get a compiler that lists out a ton of errors. For example, you may have not known that an identifier had to be declared. So you get an undeclared identifier, but it turns out you don't get one message, you get one for each time you use it. So you make it dozens. And if you're just learning programming and you're intimidated to begin with, you say, oh my God, I just started and I've got 35 errors. It's going to take me weeks to fix this. That's not true. You had one error that occurred in 35 positions, but one fix will do it. And in fact, apropos to what I discussed, how could you go ahead and essentially make the case that if I had 35 uses of an undeclared identifier and I really wanted to print out an error message, I printed it out only once. Because remember what it says is there. Here is all the places where it was used, but the error is that this identifier was undeclared. And if you put a declaration in on it, that one fix fixes it. What's this old error type again? What you could do, now I'm not saying you want to do it now, but just looking forward, is the first time you find that undeclared identifier, you put it in the symbol table as an undeclared identifier. And now each time somebody uses it, they look it up and say, what's its type? I suggested it be error. Well, an error type has this particular property. It does not generate new errors. There's an old dictum in computing, garbage in, garbage out. And in computing, that means sometimes if something's messed up, it'll generate not one potential error message, but maybe many. For example, it's undeclared, it's also being type checked to see if it's perhaps an integer. Now, if it's undeclared, you say it's undeclared, but you also don't want to say it's not an integer. It isn't, but you don't know what it is, so why complain about something that isn't really an issue yet? So when the user fixes it, they may get a second message. Okay, that's fair if they go ahead and made the second error. First, it was undeclared. That's bad. And secondly, you should have made it integer. You didn't. That's another error. So two errors and two messages make sense. So what, in your particular case, I would simply go ahead and each spot print out the error message, assuming if there are physically three declarations in the same scope of the same identifier, at least two of them have to be fixed, maybe all three. But so that makes sense there. Other questions? Okay, good. Let's talk a little bit about what we were getting into, and that was scanning and possibly the odd way I was doing scanning. Because in the old days, and perhaps the way you would have expected it, is a scanner reads characters, creates tokens, and the way to do that, and I'll show you some code later that actually does that, that reads the characters and said, are you a this, are you a that, or something else? So if you're a digit, you may be part of an integer literal. If you're a character, you may be part of an identifier or part of a reserved word or part of many reserved words if they have multiple reserved words that begin with the same letter. So if, for example, if and in were both reserved words, when you see an I, you say, hey, this might be the identifier I. I got to keep reading. But it also may be a prefix of if. It may be a prefix of in. And depending on language, even other possibilities. So the code would have to check for all that. That gets tedious and difficult to maintain in that if you make a minor change in the definition, like add one more reserved word that begins with I, the code may have to be changed quite substantially. So our approach is the code will be automatically generated, and if it gets changed quite substantially, we don't see the changes, it just happens, and therefore we don't feel responsible. So the approach we're going to take is this notion of regular expressions. These are patterns, and I talked a little bit about that last time. They're patterns that represent not numbers like a lot of things in computing do, but rather identifiers or identifier sequences. Some of that already exists. When you do, for example, a search in a program in an editor, you can say, find me something that begins with an I or an I in or something like that. You can do searches. Oftentimes, you can make them case insensitive. But what's limiting in a lot of these editors, and you may have noticed it yourself, is they don't give you the flexibility to be even more precise. In my case, my name is Fisher, last name. It's spelled with the German way, with a C, because my ancestors emigrated in the 1800s from Germany, I think around the 1840s when there were revolutions and all. A lot of times, my name is misspelled without the C, and I accept that. But if I, for example, were searching documents and I wanted to find all the references to me to find out what bad things were people were saying, just searching for my proper name in upper or lower case, depending on whether people capitalize or not, is not enough. I'd want to say, look for Fisher, but accept both variations. And I could do two searches, but an alternative would be a pattern that says, when you get to the SC, allow the SC or allow the C. That is, that C in that one context could be there or it could be avoided. And you can think of other situations. If you have even tougher names, there are some people whose names are never spelled right. I think I had an Indian fellow last semester whose last name had a good 20 letters. And I asked him whether in Hindi it was any shorter, and it wasn't. It's just that certain nationalities have long names. If you know some people who are Polish, Polish sometimes have long names and they're absolutely unpronounceable situation there. Anybody who's a baseball fan, there was a fellow who played for the Minnesota Twins named Herbeck. And I think the cool thing about Herbeck was there was only one vowel in the whole name, because I think he was Slavic of something, maybe Serbian or something, Croatian, whatever. And that's the way those names were. So you can imagine searching for patterns, you know, where things are almost bound to be misspelled. The point is, tools exist to allow you the flexibility to say, here's what I want to match, without matching everything. I could, for example, simply try to match everything that began with F and end in R. But now I get a ton of names that aren't at all relevant to me, and that's not so good either. So that's one of the notions of why these patterns are interesting, and they crop up in a variety of places, certainly in our case, in scanner generators. So I'm going to be talking more about these patterns later, and did everybody get an assignment? Were there enough to go around? Cool. So what I'll do a little later in there, we'll actually go ahead and look at some of the token definitions using this notation that you're actually going to have to handle. Some of them are remarkably trivial. They're simply a single character, like a comma or a left paren or a semicolon. Others are not so bad. They're an integer, which is a run of digits, optionally with a leading sign. Other things like quoted strings are a deal more complex, because quoted strings have to allow certain escape characters in the text of the string. And I'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk about comments and a variety of things. So some will be quite simple. Some will be more complex. Another thing that this allows and we'll have to handle is that we can have one or more definitions that match the same input. An example of that is if I have a definition of an identifier. A very simple definition is any run of letters. Usually you allow digits too, but just any run of letters, one or more. But that overlaps reserved words like if or else or then. So you have to have some way of saying, if I have two or more definitions that match, here's the priority. If you match and you match, you're the winner, you're the loser, even though you fit the pattern, this guy has priority. And the way we handle it is reserved words get priority because they're reserved. There's a situation there. I was just eating lunch at the Great Dane today, you know, as one of the things we have. And somebody was saying they went back trying to find parking, and there was a parking spot with a little label on it. It says reserved for Bo Ryan. Now, Bo Ryan, of course, is the basketball coach at UW. He was also in the news recently because they had a list of the most overpaid people working for the UW system. And who do you think was very top of the list? Not me. If it was, I wouldn't be boasting about it. Probably wouldn't be here. I'd probably be in Antigua or somewhere knocking back some drinks that have little umbrellas in them. So who do you think was the highest paid UW? This is a whole UW system, not just Madison, but Milwaukee and Parkside and all the various campuses. Well, come on, I gave you the answer. It's Bo Ryan. And did anybody see the list of what he made? Foolish person. No, Alvarez makes $1 million, and he was not top of the list. 2.4 million. It's good to go to the Final Four, real good to go to the Final Four. So at any rate, they had a little thing reserved for him, and reserved words are kind of like that. So if you're just an ordinary person or an ordinary identifier, you don't get the park there. But if it's reserved for Bo Ryan, and the reason he does it is apparently they do a sports show from the Great Dane in Hilldale about basketball once a week. And of course, we can't have Bo coming and not being able to find a parking spot, and hence not being able to be on the show, or even worse, having to go into one of the parking structures at Hilldale and walk half a block. So it's got to be real close, and so it pays to be important. So at any rate, we'll be talking about those patterns as a cool idea in general and as a very useful way of doing what otherwise would be a slightly nasty problem in building a scanner. One of the problems with the patterns is it's nice to specify them, but it's not so clear how you program them. So what some very smart computer scientists have come up with was a notion of a very specialized machine that has to be implemented specially, but is really cool for matching characters. The reason is it's designed specifically for that. It says, if you see a character, do this. If you see another character, do that. And if you don't see any match at all, stop. As simple as you might imagine. So it turns out the way these patterns work is they're first translated into these specialized machines called finite automata. The finite automata are then implemented by tables in a way that computers can handle more readily. So it's a little less evident how they're implemented, but it certainly is doable. And in fact, what we'll do then is encode the finite automata, just what I was talking about, in tables. And tables just means one or more groups of numbers, you know, one dimensional is a vector, two dimension, three dimension, with little numbers saying this represents this and that represents that. This is stuff that's automatically generated, so you neither have to read it nor understand it, but just appreciate that it's something a computer can handle quite readily. The tables can get big. In the old days, that was problematic. Gee, some of those tables might be kilobytes in size. Oh my gosh, it needs 10 kilobytes of memory. And once upon a time, that was an issue. But now that's such a small thing that, you know, don't tell me about kilobytes, and tell me about megabytes or gigabytes, or now we're talking terabytes. This little guy here has half a terabyte of hard drive implemented as flash. And I'm sure, you know, many of you have machines that have even more. Main memory, you know, situation. It's not terabytes yet, but it's certainly multiple gigabytes. In fact, last semester we played a little game about who has the biggest, but in this case, who had the biggest memory. You know, it's more, a little more polite. So it's a situation, who had the biggest memory? And we had one guy who worked for NVIDIA. These are guys that make the graphic cards that you need if you have these real hotshot games. And I think he had 24 gigabytes of memory in his machine. And I'm sure you can get more if you got the money to pay for it. Any of you have 24 gigabytes as your main memory? You do! How many? 24. God, yeah, you must do some great cool things. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just think about 24 billion bytes of main memory for one person. And I'm sure you do very important things, but it's not like you're the only person in the world who needs a computer and therefore you get the ultimate priority. But certainly things change in that. So this sort of encoding is something we'll have to worry about, but size is not the issue it once was. What we'll then do in particular is use a tool. And this is a tool that really will be the bulk of the work you do as you're programming, something called JLEX. All that stands for is LEX, which is a long-standing scanner generator, goes all the way back to the earliest days of Unix. LEX was a lexical, they called it a lexical scanner, and hence the name LEX. And JLEX is, of course, just Java LEX. So it automates the process in that you'll give it rules that say, here's a pattern that represents a token. Some of them are remarkably trivial, like here's a comma, and you just show it the comma symbol. Or here's a plus. Turns out plus has to be quoted because it can be used as an operator, but it's still quote plus quote, pretty simple. And then you give it a block of code that says, here's what I want you to do when you decide this is in fact the next token. How does it decide? Your problem. Don't bother me. You figure it out. You're the scanner. I tell you, you find this guy. This is what I want you to do. And in many cases, it's as simple as saying, please return to the user that I found a token, and you'll give the token name that says, oh, I'm the token that represents a comma, or I'm the token that represents a plus, or an identifier, or a string, or whatever it might happen to be. So each line is pretty easy. A pattern, some of the patterns are trivial, some aren't, and a little bit of code that says, essentially, return to the user what I've seen. In other applications, you can do other things. I'll have an example, perhaps later today, of using LEX to solve a word matching problem, partially because it's an easy thing to see and partially because it makes sense in terms of something LEX could do that's not scanning, but still something that would be of use. And this is a variation on saying, I'm thinking of a word, and the word is 5 characters long, and it begins with this and ends with this, and what is it? And turns out that, you know, if you do crossword puzzles, that's a handy thing. In the old days, I used to have to look up crossword solutions in a dictionary, and that was a real bear. Now, of course, I'm sure they must have apps. Anybody here who does crossword puzzles, there must be some cool apps that say, oh, I've got a crossword puzzle and, you know, it's seven letters long and I know the first, the fifth, and the last, and please give me some hints. Doesn't exist. Hey, no, I got to believe that. As popular as crossword puzzles, there must be apps around that do it. Otherwise, we can just use this tool here to kind of generate those as we go. So we'll get into that. Okay, and let's bring this guy back to life. In the past, you pull this out and then put it back in. Oh, come on, guy. There we go. My guy's coming to life. I may have to try this one more time. Oh, there we go. Cool. So what I was talking about last time, we just had started, was these patterns, these so-called regular expressions. Now, regular expression is just a name. Probably a better name would be character expressions, but that's not what they chose. So regular, I guess, just means because they have certain regularity about it. But essentially, there are various operations that I can give you little bits of a pattern and build up bigger patterns. And again, if you look at the assignment, let's see if I have a copy here. Is there an extra floating around? Of the assignment I just passed around and save one for myself. Oh no, one's coming up here. There were some extras. Thank you very much. Anybody who didn't get one, I'll have some extras up here. So if you look at that assignment and just turn to page 2, for example, we'll start to see some of those patterns. In fact, why don't I put it up here? I don't expect this to be totally readable, but you have one in front of you, so that's not an issue. Some are specified very simply by simply giving their text in order. So for example, there are examples like bool, if, int are reserved words, because we said they are, and that means if I see those characters, they have to be recognized. Let me warn you about a little gotcha here, namely, we have this rule that says that the case is irrelevant in CSX. And that means if somebody cares to, they can spell these guys in uppercase or lowercase or mixed case, and it doesn't change the meaning. Some languages have that. Other languages have the situation that a reserve must be only in lowercase or only in uppercase. I'm giving you the more general problem, because if you can figure out how to do that, you can certainly do the easier one. And it's sort of an open question situation. Sometimes, for example, people do things like reserve words in uppercase, or in Eclipse, I think they're put in black, where identifiers are put in blue. Just some way of saying, these look similar, but they're really different, and I'm going to give you a clue of what that is. Going down to identifiers, we'll get to this a little more, but this is a fancy way, which I haven't explained yet, so don't feel bad about it, that says an identifier is a mixture of letters, and if you look through the right, there's digits involved, and there's some repetition that'll explain how that works, and then this minus reserved is sort of a hint saying, oh, by the way, if it's reserved, doesn't count. So if Bo Ryan wants that spot, he gets it, even though it's empty right now, because you're not Bo, and you don't make $2.4 million. And we'll go through these, but as you can see, some of them are pretty easy. Like other tokens, they're simply individual characters or pairs of characters. Some, like string literals and character literals, are a little bit more complex, and we'll get into that. And one of the nice things about these patterns is they're simple when they can be simple, and they're a little more involved when you have a more complex structure in mind. And you can imagine that real programming languages may have more complex sequences still. In fact, I can guarantee you that. For example, when we get to string literals, I only have a few escaped characters. Most real languages have ways to create a wide variety of escaped characters. That is, these are characters that are not normally printable, but are real honest-to-gosh characters. There's the bell character, there's the null character, and a variety. In fact, see, in ASCII, all characters below blank, which is octal 40, which is decimal 32, so 31 characters below, and it turns out octal 177, the very last character, is also unprintable. So you have 30-some characters which exist but aren't printable and therefore can't be written down in the conventional way. And if for some reason you wanted to have those in a string, there has to be some sort of escape sequence that talks about them. Some you don't care much about. Others are important enough that they have their own escape sequences. And if you ever read details of a language like C or C++ or Java or C Sharp, you'll see those details when you read about how quoted strings are created. So at any rate, what we're going to be doing is we first start out with sequences that are simply characters in order. That's called catenation or sometimes concatenation. It's whichever grammatical term you prefer. After that, there's alternation. And with, excuse me, with alternation, we can get some interesting notions. For example, oftentimes when we want a digit, we'll take any of the 10 digits, 0 through 9. And we'd like to say, here's a way of specifying all the various digits. So what we do is we use OR bars to represent alternatives. Parens are used as delimiters. And each of the individual digits represents itself. And in this case, I've given it a name. I'll show you later how to do that in JLEX. But just think of like mathematics where you say, let pi equals blah, 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 and so on. And instead of writing down the long digit sequence, you write down pi. In this case, I can write down digit. And it says you can match any one single digit. Later on, I'll show you how to match a sequence of digits, zero or more, or one or more, depending on what your requirement is. Certain characters, as it mentions here, are called metacharacters. That is, they're used in more than one way. They're used as operators, like the OR bar, but they can also be individual characters. And there has to be some way of escaping those. And typically, you use quotation or the backslash escape sequence to say, I don't mean this to be an operator, like a paren or an OR bar. I mean this to be the actual honest-to-gosh character, left paren, right paren, vertical bar. And please interpret it as that. That's one of the things you have to be careful in scanning, because you are the people that put the magic in certain escape sequences. I mentioned this last week, and I'll get it again, because it's a hard thing to appreciate. If you programmed in a variety of languages, backslash n, and now I got some space here. So backslash n represents new line. But at what point does it become magic? I mean, that's an invisible character, and I've written it down in visible form. It happens when the scanner, either for characters or strings, says, hey, users sometimes need to specify things they can't write down directly. I could put a new line, for example, but you couldn't see it, and it would likely be misinterpreted as simply a line break, ending this line and going to the next one. So you have a rule that says I can have the special character pair backslash new line in a quoted string, but when that's seen, that does not mean the two characters backslash followed by n. It means the one invisible character new line. And it turns out that if I want to get the actual two characters new line, character backslash new line, what I have to do is escape the backslash. So a pair of backslashes means this is not the magic backslash, this is simply the character backslash. And once this becomes ordinary, then I have that. So if I wanted to write down the two characters backslash n and have them print out in a string, for example, I would write down the three characters. And I have to do that because I bought into the magic for the backslash n, therefore I have to have a way to turn off the magic in cases where I really want not the new line, but simply two characters that oftentimes represent the new line. So we'll get into that, but that starts to show you some of the power of the system, but also some of the requirements you have in doing a scanner properly. So here's an example up top where I have certain characters quoted, and in this particular case, I can quote or I can escape. That says, well, certain characters like left paren and right paren are magic. And I'll have a table later on that shows you the various operators and which ones have special meaning and what they're used for. So once we have alternation, I can go ahead and start building bigger patterns by saying I can have a choice of what I put in a particular particular definition. So the example I use here, I can define LC as lowercase. That's a list of all the 26 lowercase letters, A or B or C or so on. Turns out, you're saying to yourself, oh my gosh, am I going to have to write down these things that tediously? And the answer is no. We have some nice abbreviations, which we'll introduce, that you can essentially just say A through Z. And in fact, if I wanted to, I'll show you the notation now, just so when I get to it later, it won't look totally foreign. The left and right brackets represent what's called a character class, and I'll get to that. And A to Z is a dash. Says, give me everything from A to Z in order. So that represents 26 letters using only five, and a nice convenient way of doing that. And it happens, these sort of things can be used in other regular expression patterns, but certainly will use it. Similarly, I could do uppercase. And that would be 26 more letters. Oftentimes, when you have identifiers, you can mix them, upper, lowercase, it doesn't matter. So rather than writing down 52, I can say lowercase or uppercase. And that represents an expression that says choose something that's lowercase or uppercase. And in this case, I then get 52. So alternation gives me a way of giving you a choice. In some cases, I can have a choice or choose not to have something, and I'll show you how alternation can allow you to say, I had an option, but I chose not to use it. And that'll be by using a special symbol that we'll get to in a bit. So far, we've seen the obvious operators, sequencing and alternation, those you'd expect. But we have to have some way of repeating choices to get longer definitions. And the way to do that is by using an iteration operator that's called clean closure. And it's a star operator. And remember last time I showed you the star can be used in Unix, for example, to represent any particular file pattern at all. This is the original motivation for it. It was named after a fellow named Steve Kleene, who was actually one of the early computer science profs at UW-Madison. He was also dean of the School of Letters and Sciences and a very, very eminent mathematician from the World War II age into the 50s and then into the 60s. And one of the many things he invented was this notion of Kleene closure, which is really just iteration. And the way it works is I can take a set, like lowercase, and just as with exponentiation, which we can actually show you later, says repeat something some number of times, twice or thrice. If I put a star as a superscript operator, turns out it is not going to be a superscript operator when we program it because superscripts are hard in computing, but mathematically that's what it is. This says you can go ahead and make zero or more choices from that set. Well, what's zero choices? That's that option I talked about. You can choose to have something or not. And the way to show you that you chose nothing at all is a special symbol called lambda that's equal to the empty string. Now, since we don't have Greek letters on most of our keyboards, at least not unless we go to Athens, where they probably do, it's oftentimes the case that in programming languages, a way to get the empty string is simply to have a quoted string with nothing between the double quotes. And as we'll see, that is in fact legal. That's another way of saying this represents nothing, if that's what you want. And it's just something that you use occasionally. If you've used string variables in various programs, it's oftentimes the case that a string variable can be initialized to the empty string, representing nothing at all. If you're in a language like Java, you have string objects, which are not quite the same thing as string variables, and there sometimes people use a null reference to represent the empty string. I'll talk more about that later, but it's one of the nasty things about programming is that sometimes programming is unclear as to whether you want to have a null choice or no choice at all. And it's one of these things you don't appreciate until you get in a situation where it makes a difference. Every 10 years, they do a census in the United States, and you're all old enough that you may have crossed paths with a census taker. And the census taker asks the obvious things, but sometimes if you're a very lucky person, they ask you some of the non-obvious things. In the old days, they used to ask if you had indoor plumbing. Now, most everybody has indoor plumbing, so they don't bother asking about that. But they ask a lot of other details. One of the things they might ask you is how many children you have. Now, most people, not all necessarily, are willing to mention that. But one of the things you have as a census taker is an ambiguity if you use the number zero for how many children you have. It may, of course, mean you have no children. Okay, obviously, that's a possibility. But you can also use the zero for an alternative meaning. And what would that be? That you don't know. Part of the trouble is imagine, if not this census, certainly in future, the census taker won't have those old paper forms. They'll have some sort of nice tablet. And, tablet, click, push in there, and you're in the records. But it turns out that most computer programs don't differentiate between don't know. So initially, before they have anything on you, they don't know your name. That's where your null string might come in. They don't know your age. That's where zero might come in. And they don't know how many children you have. That's where zero would come in. Some of those would be obvious that what you mean. If it says, is your name null string? Situation that means I don't give my name out. I'm not sure if that's legal. I think you have to give the census taker your name so you can tell them, you know, Elmer Fudd or something like that, that they would appreciate. Is your age zero? Well, if you're old enough to be telling them what your age is, it's probably not zero. But this thing about having zero children is an ambiguity, and it makes a difference. Because if the census taker, say, just had a bad day and wanted to get to lunch and didn't bother asking you how many children you had, they could report a zero, which initially meant didn't know, and yet you do in fact have children, and that would make a difference in the accuracy of the records. So one of the things we'll be getting to, and in programming languages, is how do we differentiate don't know, not specified, uninitialized, call it what you want, versus I do know, and it's a null answer, the null string. What's my middle initial? Some of you don't have middle initials, not everybody does, so your middle initial is the null string probably. How many children you have might be zero because they don't know, or it might be zero because you have no children. And differentiating that is important. So it sounds like a minor thing, but getting information right is what computing is all about. And having situations where something like the null reference could mean don't know, for example, in a string, or I do know, and it's the null string, you have no middle initial, is something we'll have to talk about. And I'm just setting that up right now as something that's interesting. So in our mathematical formulation, we'll use lambda, but there'll be other ways of representing a null string. But it is a very important thing because in many cases you have an option and you choose not to use it. And in fact, let me give you one of those now that I've set it all up. Suppose I'm writing down an integer. So an integer would be easy to write down now that I know about it. I can say it's got the digits 0 through 9. Remember, the square bracket says, give me any one digit in the range 0 to 9. I can put a star there. In fact, no, the star is not quite correct. I haven't quite got to what it should be yet. But that would allow an empty sequence of digits. But I could also say numbers typically are allowed to have a sign. It can be plus or minus, or it can be unsigned, which I guess is implicitly plus. So if you say, how cold is it outside? And somebody tells you it's 73. And you're Miami, that means 73 degrees above zero. If it says, how cold is it out there? And it says 40, and you're in Madison, it might mean minus 40 as easily as plus 40. Okay? This time of year, it's much more likely. I think I heard on the radio this morning that the all-time high record in Madison for this day is 43 degrees. But you should be glad I'm still here. I should be on a plane to Miami or Palm Springs or something like that. So at any rate, I could say you have a choice of a plus sign. I put that in quotes because plus will be used in a bit as special, or a minus sign. That's because I don't want it to be mistaken for that, or no sign at all. And all of a sudden I have something which is a more complex pattern, but also more accurate. And again, I still have to worry about the fact I probably want at least one digit. There's one way of doing that, by the way. It's ugly, but I'll write it down. It's ugly because I write more than I care to. This says at least one digit. I can have extra digits in front. I could also put them in behind. It wouldn't matter. And as a prefix, I can have a single plus sign or a single minus sign or no sign at all. Lambda says I had a choice of a sign and I chose not to put one in there. So that's an example of where lambda is useful. To be complete, mathematicians have added a couple of other issues. One of them I've talked about. Namely, you can have the empty set. That means a definition that defines nothing. That's in there for completeness, but we'll never use it. If you define nothing, what's the use of using the system? Lambda, I've talked about, is very important. And implicitly, you can simply write down a sequence of characters concatenated together by writing them in order. So ABC means the string ABC, and that's just notational convenience. So now we have the rule that says how to make big expressions out of small ones, and we'll be using that in our example of tokens. I can take two expressions representing something trivial, like a single character or a single sequence of characters, and concatenate them together. That's precisely what I did here. I said this is a prefix, that is a suffix, smash them together, you get a sign, maybe, and you get one or more digits for sure. So a sign followed by a sequence of digits is a signed integer. I can have alternation, use that there, and I can have repetition that says I might want to have my number be very long. So in this particular case, I'll have the number have as many digits as I care to have it. The trend in scanning and in tokens is to allow as long a definition as user wants. In the old days, it was the case that oftentimes identifiers and other items were limited in size because of limitations in the size of memory. So some of you go way back, you may remember the case where your user ID had to be no more than 8 characters. In fact, I was really amazed that I was just over the weekend, I was signing on to an online banking system, which ought to be very secure. And I said, oh, hey, it's time to change your password. And I changed my password. And I said, you didn't change your password. And what happened was this silly thing has the password be no more than 8 characters long. And I appended something at the end of my existing password so that it was easy to remember the change. I think that was poor design. I had to write them in there and tell them that. But in the old days, there used to be limitations on things. And the trend in scanning is there are no limitations. So our definitions will say, if you want an identifier that's 100 characters long, you can have it. You want an integer that's 100 characters long, you can have it. Somebody says, oh, wait a minute. You can't have an integer that's 100 characters long. It'd be too big. It would overflow. And the answer is wrong. Here's one that, and let's assume those are 100 digits. So now if I want to be perverse, I can simply go ahead and hold the repeat button down and generate as many zeros as possible. Now, why would I do that? So I want to see if I can break your program. I don't know, do they have it here? That many organizations have something called quality assurance. And they do have this here. Yeah. I mean, it takes a special breed of person and situation. I always thought if I was in industry, I might be a great quality assurance person. The reason for that is your job is to make all your colleagues who aren't in quality assurance look like fools. And the better you do your job, the worse off somebody may be. And in fact, one time I actually got to see the treasures of Tutankhamun in Seattle, Washington, by being a bad guy quality assurance. Long story short, we visited Seattle, University of Seattle, to test the compiler for somebody. And it happened just by the sheerest of chance that it was the time when the treasures of Tutankhamun were touring the United States. And it was in Seattle. It was the middle of the week, and by gosh, there were no lines. In Chicago, which is the nearest city to Madison that had it, there were huge lines way around the Field Museum where they had it. So my buddy and I, in fact, my buddy actually was working for Epic now, and he may have actually told you the story if he did it. He says, we got to get out of here early. We're going to miss a chance of a lifetime. So we played every dirty trick we could imagine to break a compiler. And one of them was we held down identifiers that were 1,000 characters long. Digits, you know, valid things, digits 0000000, and all kinds of crazy combinations. You know, situation, if statements that had if with an if with an if with an if with an if, going down dozens and dozens and dozens of levels. So what happens is we found many errors. I won't say how many because I don't remember. Before lunch. And the poor guy doing the testing said, okay, I understand. We're not ready for prime time yet. We don't need your services anymore. So my colleague and I, we went out, got a quick lunch, and we saw the treasures of Tutankhamun. So you see, sometimes being a bad guy gets you good rewards because, and that was great. I mean, I don't think that, those treasures will ever come again to the United States. I think it was around the time of the bicentennial or something, and it was just a special treat. And if ever you get to Cairo, it's something worth seeing, but certainly something, one chance in a lifetime, and I managed to grab it. So at any rate, there are cases where we'll have relatively no limit. That also means length of lines will not be limited, but an automatic scanner doesn't worry about that. And it turns out that can sometimes be important because how long something is or not can, again, affect how something is implemented. If you have extremely long identifiers, extremely long tokens, extremely long lines, things have to be programmed more carefully than they otherwise would be. But that's not our problem. That's JLEX's problem. So one of the things we'll do as a trivial subset is oftentimes I simply have a finite set of fixed strings, and I can always handle those using regular expression notation by simply listing out the options in order. And as a simple case, if I went to the ANSI C, and at the time I was doing this, I think I was programming in C for gosh knows what reason, and I just went into the back of the book, and there was the list of reserved words and whole list of them, and I could simply list them out and feed them into a scanner. So the cool thing about that is scanning these guys would have been relatively easy. Okay, now we can go back, and it turns out I showed you clean enclosure, which is a superscript star. An alternative, which if anything is perhaps more usable than cleaning closure, is the plus operator, which says take not zero or more repetitions of the set, but one or more. It's going back to my definition here, where I said this wasn't quite as elegant. I can write down as an alternative. So I take those two guys above and put that there. And that says, go into this set. What is the set? It's individual digits. And repeat it one or more times, because I want an integer to have at least one digit. It turns out there's a mathematical equality, which I actually used here, that says, that says, if I want to simulate plus, I can simply put a set and then repeat that set with a star. So 1 plus 0 or more is equivalent to 1 or more. Or alternatively, P star is P plus with the alternative of also choosing lambda. So this is just shows there's an equivalence. If you have one, you don't really need both except as a notational convenience. Another thing that's very useful and we'll use when we're programming scanners is the complement operator for characters. So sometimes it's convenient to say, I don't want to tell you what characters I want. I want to tell you what characters I don't want. So in a situation, you know, if you have a roommate or a spouse or something, oftentimes you say, what do you want for dinner? And you say, anything but pizza. Now, I know none of you would say that because situation here, but some people actually don't like pizza every night of the week. Six nights a week is fine, but seven is a bit too much. So you can say, not what you want, but what you don't want. And in this particular case, for characters, it turns out that's sometimes handy too. One of the things you're going to have to worry about, and if you've read ahead on the assignment, you may have noticed that, is that in certain cases we say we do not allow unprintable characters. Where? Well, we don't allow them particularly in quoted strings or quoted characters. The reason is, if they're unprintable, they're normally invisible. And therefore, if I write them in a string, how do I see that they're there? The alternative is to do escapes. But that says, if, for example, you want to use a line feed, an end of line, in a quoted string, which is fine, you can't put it in there as the actual end of line character. Because when you print out or listening to that thing, the quoted string will appear to break across a line boundary, and then it won't be clear exactly where the line break is and where their blanks are, etc. So instead, you have to use a backslash new line. That's fine. Most languages do that. But it also means I have to forbid using the raw backslash, the raw new line, because I want to make sure you make it visible. So I'll take away the obvious way of doing it and make you do the escaped way. So how do I say something's unprintable? How do I list something I'm not allowed to say? Well, one way of doing it is say the printable characters and then complement them. Say, here are all the printables, but I don't want those. I want everything else but. So make that a mental note of that, and it's something which we'll have use for a little bit down the line. Turns out that good ideas sometimes get carried too far, and we have lots of examples of that situation, you know, that one slice of pizza is good, a whole pizza by yourself is not so good, unless now you're more capacious than most people are. So it's a situation, sometimes you carry a good idea too far, and let me show you one of those that exists but will not be used, and I'll kind of explain to you why. So I can complement sets of characters, which is what the not operator did. I can also complement entire regular expressions, which says, give me every string except the one in the current regular expression. Turns out that's pretty easy to do, but also turns out it's way more dangerous and misleading than you might imagine. So for example, imagine I said, I want you to show me, I want to have every string that does not contain two consecutive pound signs. And in fact, that's a little apropos because when we talk about the comments we use in our language, we actually use double pound sign to delimit comments. These are multi-line comments, comments that span more than one line. So I want to say, give me everything that does not have a double pound sign. We say, oh, hey, that's easy. I'll just complement it. And the way it's complemented following mathematical notation is an over bar. Turns out that this represents all strings that do not contain two pound signs. Can anybody give me an example of one of those? There's lots and lots of them, believe me. Well, how about this? It's one of those things, be careful what you ask for because you just may get it. All the strings that do not contain exactly two pound signs is a string that contains three pound signs. And if I didn't want two, I probably did not want three either. So This is just a situation. Sometimes imitation is more powerful than you imagine, and sometimes a clever alternative is not as clever as you might imagine. And I won't say too much more about that now, but and that's why I won't. But let me just finish my thought here, is that some of you, when you look at our definition, saying, hey, I know how comments go. They're slash star and star slash. And it turns out that's true. But getting a good definition for a comment that does slash star and star slash that exactly matches everything that begins and ends with that and doesn't contain a star slash within it is way more difficult than you might imagine. And in fact, when we get into the semester, we'll make that part of a homework assignment where you have to write down something that does that. And you'll be surprised how tricky it can be. Let me give you one little hint on that even now. If you want to test that, one way to test whether regular expressions work or not is what? Take JLEX, program it into JLEX, and run some tests and see if it works or not. And if you do that, sometimes you'll find errors that were quite unexpected. So that little tinkle was an hour up, so time for a break. I saw some people getting a little fidgety anyway. So it's now just 6:30, and we'll start again at about 6:45. And it's all dark out there now, so I hope there are not snowdrifts 3 feet high out on the prairie. We'll find out.